Blog Talk Radio.
Well, your dadgum government, you sorry so-and-sos. You got your damn hands in every pocket of my clothes. Well, your dadgum, dadgum, dadgum government. Uh-huh. Oh, don't you know? Oh, don't you love them sometimes? Uh-huh. Well, your dadgum government, you better pay attention. You're setting up there like a fool's convention. Will you dadgum, dadgum, dadgum government? Uh-huh. Oh, don't you know? Oh, don't you love me sometimes? Uh-huh.
Well, welcome to Handling the Truth with Rebel Madman and Tenacity. This is Terry Dodd, and I'm here with my co-host tonight, Mike Gaddy, and we're going to get into the Bill of Rights tonight. This is part four of our Swindled from the Beginning series, and I'm looking forward to tonight, Mike, because I know you're going to bring us some things we've never heard before, and, you know, I've always been a defender of the Bill of Rights, and now I'm hearing that, you know, it really facilitated the ratification of this unconstitutional constitution, and that it, in some ways, may have made our rights more vulnerable than they were without the Bill of Rights. And I'm really looking forward to you bringing out these historical facts. Mike, you want to open us with a prayer tonight?
Yes. Dear Lord, we thank you for all the gifts that we enjoy every day, all of the things that mean so much to us. And we thank you for your son, Jesus Christ. And place your blessings upon Terry and I tonight as we try to bring forth the truth to the people as best that we can. And thank you again, dear Lord, for everything that you have provided to all of us. We ask you to keep your hand on this country, to help us as we go through some very trying times. And we ask all these things in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. Well, Mike, I'm just going to shut up and become a student, which I do so often with you. I mean, you make that easy for me, but I really appreciate the things you've taught me already and the messages that you bring for our listeners. So, the floor is yours, kind sir.
All right. Thank you, Terry. One of the things I think that so many people, and it's not, I'm not blaming the people. We just haven't been taught the truth about our history. And, you know, after you get into it, you understand why we haven't been taught the truth of our history. And, you know, the Bill of Rights, and I've been taught about the Bill of Rights, you know, we heard that very on in our education, in our civics classes. But to really delve into source documents and to look at exactly what happened at the Constitutional Convention, and I think it would probably come as a great surprise to most people, is that the people at the Constitutional Convention, the 39 men who signed the Constitution, totally against the Bill of Rights. As a matter of fact, a vote was taken at the Constitutional Convention when George Mason made a motion, and it was seconded by Elbridge Gerry, and he made the motion to include a Bill of Rights into the Constitution. And when it went to a vote, it was voted down unanimously by state. So all of the states, their representatives from each of the states that were there at the time. Of course, Rhode Island never showed up. New York did not have a quorum, so they didn't have a vote. So it was unanimous at that time that there would be no Bill of Rights added. So it came time to sign the Constitution, and when that time came, George Mason refused to sign the Constitution and said he would rather chop off his right hand than sign a constitution without a Bill of Rights. Now, it's important we know that George Mason wrote the Virginia Declaration of Rights about a month before the Declaration of Independence, and Thomas Jefferson drew quite a bit from that Declaration of Rights when writing the Declaration of Independence. So it would be natural that Mason would not sign a constitution without a Bill of Rights. And of course, he was joined by Elbridge Gerry and Edmund Pendleton. So then we move on from there and we go into the ratification process. And of course, the majority of the people who signed the Constitution would be called Federalists, a name they gave themselves. Alexander Hamilton gave them that name. Alexander Hamilton also named those who opposed the Constitution, he called them the Anti-Federalists. So both names were given by the Federalists. And it was misleading because the Federalists were not Federalists, they were Nationalists. Hamilton was a monarchist, and he actually proposed a monarchy on June 18th of 1787. And when it wasn't accepted, he got mad and went home to New York. Of course, he did come back. But we have the ratification conventions are meeting, and suddenly the Constitution is out there among the people, and the people start yelling at their representatives. I mean that as a colloquialism. But, hey, we need a Bill of Rights. What happened to the Bill of Rights? Why don't we have a Bill of Rights? And so, of course, you had especially the New England states ratified rather quickly, Delaware, New Jersey. Well, Georgia, which is a southern state, they ratified without ever questioning the Constitution. Delaware didn't even read it. They did the Nancy Pelosi trick. Let's sign it and find out what's in it. So you end up with that situation. And so that is. So here we go. Pardon me. So we are looking at several ratification conventions, and New Hampshire brings it up about a Bill of Rights. Virginia, and Virginia started in June, basically June the 2nd of 1788, and it started, and we were already hearing clamoring for a Bill of Rights. And North Carolina, in their ratification convention, when they said we will not ratify until we get a Bill of Rights, and they refused to ratify at their first convention. Virginia brings up the point of and Virginia is critical. And Virginia is critical for many reasons, because Virginia was the largest state and the richest state in 1788. So it was important to the Union to get Virginia in. And so the ratification convention begins with 8 states having signed. We need 9. So in the middle of the Constitutional Convention, they're battling back and forth, especially Patrick Henry, James Madison, being very contentious with each other, including Edmund Randolph, who was also very contentious at that time. So suddenly James Madison has promised his fellow Federalists, Alexander Hamilton, George Washington, and the others, that Virginia would ratify. And he had promised that that would occur because they were so concerned about it. So he promised the ratification. And so Patrick Henry is very strong, very eloquent speaker. And he is talking against, for 17 days on different times, he spoke against the ratification of the Constitution. And some of those are very interesting. I promise you, some of his speeches are most interesting. So it's getting towards the end. But in the meantime, New Hampshire, in the middle of the Virginia ratification convention, so they know their 9 are there. So the 9 being there and knowing that there's going to be a union made it even a tougher task for Patrick Henry and his folks. But anyway, James Madison finally realizes as they're getting near the end that it's going to be a very close vote. And he has promised the other Federalists that Virginia would ratify. So seeing that it was getting to be a close vote, James Madison basically promises the delegates, if they will ratify the Constitution, that he will provide and secure them a Bill of Rights. And so many believe, and if you read the history books, many believe that Virginia ratified on that promise, especially Western Virginia, which at that time was Kentucky and West Virginia. They ratified on that belief. And so here we are after the – so we have a country. The first government takes office. George Washington is president. John Adams is vice president. And we have a Congress that is totally dominated by Federalists. The Anti-Federalists in the Senate – well, the Federalists had 20 members of the Senate. The Anti-Federalists had 2. So that's a 10-to-1 ratio. And in the House of Representatives, they had a 50-to-10 domination. So it was 5-to-1 in the House of Representatives. So in the meantime, all of these states have submitted their proposals for a Bill of Rights to the first Congress. Now, please bear in mind, we have Article 5 of the Constitution, which is now in play once the Constitution was ratified. We have Article 5, which stipulates how amendments can be added to the Constitution. So the states collectively sent approximately 200, a little over 200 recommendations, amendments to the first Congress. So the first Congress in the House of Representatives, they deal with it first. James Madison is being bombarded by Federalists saying, whatever you do, don't do the Bill of Rights. Let's get on. Let's continue what we started in Philadelphia. Let's get this government built. Forget the Bill of Rights. We have what we want. And Madison realizes that he can't do that. He basically, his political career, especially in Virginia, depends on following through with his promises to his constituents. So we have a situation here where 200 are sent, and of the over 200 that are sent, Madison names a commission or a committee, I'm sorry, of 11 members with Vining as the chairman, and he tells them, okay, you guys go through the 200 and you what we need to actually present as a Bill of Rights, which is totally against Article 5 of the Constitution. It's laid out specifically how amendments must be added, but the committee circumvents that, goes through the 200 plus, and realizes that there are a lot of duplications, as you would imagine. One state, says they want the same thing as another state. So you expect there to be duplications. So after the duplications are eliminated, there's a little over 100, or right at 100, amendments that are still there, that there are no duplicates. So you've got 100 submitted amendments to the Constitution. Well, if you went by Article 5 of the Constitution and you didn't violate the Constitution right out of the box, those 100 would have been sent to all of the states for ratification as the Constitution itself calls for. That didn't happen. So the committee works on those 100 and winnows that 100 down to 17. Well, this creates quite a furor among the 10 anti-federalists who are staunch Bill of Rights people. They want amendments. They've been promised amendments. So if I could jump now to Sentinel, who wrote as an anti-federalist, who was Samuel Bryan, and to jump to Sentinel number 19, Samuel Bryan talks about the amendments. And this is what he says in Sentinel 19. And for those of you who would be interested in seeing all of the Sentinel essays, you can get a book with all 24 of Sentinel's essays from Amazon for about $930. That is how much they want to make sure people don't read Sentinel's essays. But anyway, like a barrel thrown to the whale, the people were to be amused with fancied amendments until the harpoon of power should secure its prey and render resistance ineffectual. So Samuel Bryan was saying that the amendments were just going to be thrown out there, to try to pacify the people, to shut them up while they get the government instituted that they want to get instituted. Pardon me. And, of course, Samuel Bryan got that from a novel by Jonathan Swift, and I'll quote the line from Jonathan Swift. Seamen have a custom when they meet a whale to fling him out an empty tub by way of amusement to divert him from laying violent hands upon the ship. Here we are with 100 amendments which should have been sent to the states for ratification, but this committee, and would it surprise you to know that everyone on that committee is a Federalist? So the Federalists winnowed through the amendments that they didn't want to start with, that they voted against in the Constitutional Convention. So they go through those and they bring them down to 17. And then in the heat of August of 1789, these begin to be debated within the House of Representatives. And, of course, Madison supports them because he promised the people they would be there. So they have this list of amendments. And suddenly, I'm trying to think of his name, Tudor Tucker, Thomas Tudor Tucker of South Carolina, he does the unforgivable because he has a list of the amendments and that were submitted by South Carolina. And so he brings the ones that have been kicked out. He starts bringing them back up within the Committee of the Whole. And it creates a furor among the Federalists who dominate the House of Representatives, 5-1, as I said before. So it brings up this furor, and this is something we have never been taught. And I found this in going back through letters, and I found 141 letters, Terry, that were written by members of Congress to each other during this period or to their constituents, or to, like several people wrote to Patrick Henry in Virginia because he wasn't in the Congress. So they wrote to him. Some of the other people wrote to their constituents in Boston, other places. But if you go into those letters, you can find what was going on at these debates. And as I said before, I was never taught this at either the high school or, grammar or the middle school or the college level. Taught about the debates that took place with the Bill of Rights. It's like they suddenly appeared out of nowhere. But they have some really contentious discussions. And how many of us knew that the discussions became so contentious during, I think, like August 15th to August the 22nd, they became so contentious that actually members of the House of Representatives actually challenged each other to duels because they were so contentious. So anyway, we have 17 of these that are finally brought out. And ironically, here was something. Every state of the ones, the 11 states, from every state came one amendment that was predominant in each of the 11 states. And that amendment was not included at all by the committee. So why would the committee eliminate the most popular amendment issue? They wanted to make sure that that wasn't brought up. Well, Thomas Tudor Tucker of South Carolina, he brings it up repeatedly. And it becomes quite contentious because the amendment that all the states had said they wanted submitted for ratification was the amendment which says no direct taxes shall ever be placed on the people by the federal government. That power rested with the states and the federal government could not submit any form of taxation on the people. Well, imagine the Federalists who had written the Constitution and put Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, which gave the federal government unlimited taxation powers from unlimited sources. Can you imagine why the Federalists decided they couldn't even let the people see this amendment, much less vote on it? So here is one of the things that we know that began to happen. Time. And James Madison, for even bringing them up, is being terribly ridiculed, even publicly, in newspapers, and especially a particular article by none other than Noah Webster. And so Webster goes after him in the press, and I think it is critical, and I would like to read this. And Webster wouldn't use his own name in the press, and it was in the New York press, and he called himself Pacificus. And so on August the 14th, when he finds out that Madison has submitted these proposal for amendments, here is what Noah Webster, a staunch Federalist, put in the New York paper. And I quote, "In a debate upon the impost bill, you declared yourself an enemy to local attachments and said you considered yourself not merely the representative of Virginia, but of the United States. This declaration was liberal and the sentiment just." People remember, liberal didn't mean then what it does now. "But, sir, does this accord with the interest you take in amending the Constitution? You now hold out in justification of the part you take in forwarding amendments that you have pledged yourself in some measure to your constituents. But, sir, who are your constituents? Are they the electors of a small district in Virginia? These indeed gave you a place in the federal legislature. But the moment you were declared to be elected, you became the representative of 3 million of people, and you are bound by the principles of representation and by your own declaration to promote the general good of the United States. You had no right to declare that you would act upon the sentiments and wishes of your immediate constituents unless you should be convinced that the measures you advocate coincide with the wishes and the interests of the entire Union. Permit me then, with great respect, to ask, sir, how you can justify yourself in the eyes of the world for espousing the cause of amendments with so much earnestness. Do you, sir, believe that the people you represent generally wish for amendments? If you do, sir, you are more egregiously mistaken than you ever were before. I know from the unanimous declaration of men in several states through which I have lately traveled that amendments are not generally wished for. On the other hand, amendments are not mentioned, but with the most pointed disapprobation." Well, Noah Webster just lied through his teeth, because the states sent over 200 suggestions for amendments, and he says in the several states where he's been, nobody wants one. And he made this public to put pressure onto James Madison to try to get him to withdraw any amendments to the Constitution. Gives you a chance to look at who the Federalists are and who the Anti-Federalists are and what they stood for. The Anti-Federalists insisted on a Bill of Rights. The Federalists said no. They didn't want one. So here we are. It's whittled down to 17. So the 17 are sent to the Senate, Terry. And the Senate, I remind you, is 10-1 in favor of the Federalists. So the only two Anti-Federalists in the U.S. Senate in 1789 are both from the state of Virginia, and they are William Grayson and Richard Henry Lee. And those two men sent copious letters out to, like, Patrick Henry especially, talking about the process that was taking place. Now, it's hard to understand what actually took place in the Senate, because the first Senate of the United States met in secret. No one was allowed to see their proceedings, much like the Constitution itself. So all we have are the notes that are made and how the 17 amendments were basically just ripped to shreds by the Senate, and especially one factor in particular which was the 10th Amendment, which we all look at now. And we wonder, okay, why everyone thinks the 10th Amendment is very good. And so you read it and you go out, and these powers that are not delegated to the federal government, and I'm paraphrasing, are delegated to the states, and that is the way the Senate got it. That's where it ended. The Senate in 1789 added or to the people. Now, without the letters, you do not understand what they meant with the comma and then or to the people, because when I read it for years, when it says these powers are delegated to the states or to the people, we assume that it's or to the people of the states, and that was not the intention of the Senate. They did not need to add or to the people because they'd already said it belongs in the states. And, Terry, what's the first three words of the preamble of the Constitution?
We the people.
So they finagled the 10th Amendment to say that we either leave it to the powers are left to the state, comma, or to the people, and the Senate meant the people in aggregate. So the 10th Amendment, taken as written, which we say we want the Constitution as written, if we take it as written, it says that the powers either belong to the state or to the people in aggregate, which means the other states can overrule the state that is claiming its rights under the 10th Amendment. And that was something that just really surprised me. I never even thought of that until I got into reading these letters. So in the course of this huge argument in the Senate of the two men who stood up for it, these two men, Richard Henry Lee and William Grayson, decided they would publish a broadside, which was a newspaper article, about what was going on, and they sent it there. They addressed their concerns to the governor of Virginia and also to the speaker of the Virginia legislature. And both were dated 28 September 1789 from New York. And the first one, which was sent to the governor, reads, and I quote, "We have long awaited in anxious expectations of having it in our power to transmit effectual amendments to the Constitution of the United States. And it is with grief that we now send forward propositions inadequate to the purpose of real and substantial amendments, and so far short of the wishes of our country. By perusing the Journal of the Senate, Your Excellency will see that we did in vain bring to view the amendments proposed by our convention," meaning the Virginia Convention, "and approved by our legislature. We shall transmit a complete set of the journals of both houses of Congress to your address, which, with a letter accompanying them, will entreat Your Excellency will have the goodness to lay before the honorable legislature of the ensuing meeting," unquote. Then their letter to the Speaker of the House of Delegates reads, and I quote, "We have now the honor of enclosing the proposition of amendments to the Constitution of the United States that has been finally agreed upon by Congress. We can assure you, sir, that nothing on our part has been omitted to procure the success of those radical amendments proposed by our convention and approved by the legislature of our country," and that means their state of Virginia, "which, as our constituent, we shall always deem it our duty with respect and reverence to obey. The Journal of the Senate herewith transmitted will at once show exact and how unfortunate we have been in this business. It is impossible for us not to see the necessary tendency to consolidate an empire in the natural operation of this Constitution, if no further amended than as now proposed, and it is especially impossible for us not to be apprehensive for our civil liberties, when we know of no influence in the records of history that show a people ruled in freedom when subject to one undivided government. and inhabiting a territory so extensive as that of the United States. Now, remember back then there was 13 states. And when, as it seems to us, the nature of man and of things joined to prevent it, the impracticability in such case of carrying representation on sufficiently near to the people for procuring their confidence and consequent obedience compels a resort to fear resulting from great force and executive power in government. Confederated republics, where the federal hand is not possessed of absorbing power, may permit the existence of freedom while it preserves union, strength, and safety. Such amendments, therefore, as may secure against the annihilation of the state governments we devoutly wish to see adopted. If a persevering application to Congress from the states that have been desired such amendments should fail of its object, we are disposed to think, reasoning from causes to effects, that unless a dangerous apathy should invade the public mind, it will not be many years before a constitutional number of legislatures will be found to demand another convention specifically for this purpose. 230 some years, that's what people are yelling for, but they're not going to get what they think they are. I continue. We have sent a complete set of the journals of each House of Congress, and through the appointed channel will be transmitted the acts that have passed this session. In those will be seen the nature and extent of the judiciary, the estimated expenses of the government, and the means so far adopted for defraying the latter. Unquote. So, comments so far, Terry?
Well, I wrote you a note on the IM that your sound's been kind of coming and going, fading in and out. I don't know if you're on a speaker or what you're doing, but it's been a little bit iffy. Well, the thing that strikes me is, have you seen all 100 of these proposed amendments?
I have looked through. Virginia sent 40, and I have a copy of those. They sent 20 to amend the government itself, and then they sent another 20 to ensure the rights of the people. And almost all of those were totally eliminated. And I have seen those. I don't happen to have the copy in front of me. But that is, and we know that New Hampshire sent some, North Carolina sent some. Once they ratified after the Bill of Rights was out there because they said they would not do it without a Bill of Rights. So they got North Carolina to ratify because of the 12 that they sent, and 10 were ratified. And what was amazing to me, Terry, was I found that some states in this union did not ratify the Bill of Rights until 1939.
What?
Yes. There were actually some states that didn't. They did not ratify the Bill of Rights. Some states, they had enough for passage. They had two-thirds, but some of the states that didn't ratify, I mean three-quarters, the states that didn't ratify initially didn't ratify, their amendments didn't ratify the Bill of Rights until 1939.
Wow. Was there any of those Bill of Rights that are not in the Bill of Rights that leaped out at you as could have been important?
Well, direct taxation was one. The supremacy clause and they wanted something to negate the supremacy clause, as especially about treaties, and they were especially worried about treaties being the supreme law of the land. And almost every state wanted that taken out of the Constitution. And their amendments to do so were all, as we would say, thrown on the cutting room floor. They were concerned in one of the articles that it said that only a majority of the senators present can vote to make a I think that's an Article 2 someplace, that that all you need is a majority of the senators present. And Patrick Henry was all over that, and he said, oh, I can just see now a president calling in five of his favorite senators and saying, okay, three of you need to vote for this, and it would become the supreme law of the land. The states were very concerned about that, but they didn't get anything done about it. So technically today, that still stands in the Constitution. If you could say, if the other party, the one that you oppose, if that one called in five of his favorite senators and said, okay, I'm submitting this treaty, I need three of you to say okay, then it actually becomes the supreme law of the land. Especially becomes scary now, Terry, with the fact that they're proposing to put an amendment to let the UN control our Second Amendment rights. So that especially is disconcerting, that all you need is five senators. Well, you could actually bring in three and have two of them vote for it. You'd still have the majority, and it would still be constitutional. That was very disconcerting to the states. That was one of them. But the thing that troubled them most was the direct taxation. They wanted some way to limit the necessary and proper clause. They wanted to put, and Thomas Tudor Tucker fought extremely hard with the 10th Amendment to get the word expressly put into the Constitution, I mean into the Bill of Rights, especially the 10th Amendment. But the point was, is that the person who kept voting against it and kept saying no was James Madison himself. And, you know, the people at the 10th Amendment Center and other places think, well, wow, we've got the greatest guy going here in James Madison. But he did not want the word expressly used in the Constitution, in the 10th Amendment. He did not want the powers expressly listed, which basically means that with the necessary and proper clause and with the supremacy clause, Congress can make, do anything they want to. And he knew that. And so that's why, but with the majority, I think he got six Federalists to switch over to his side, and the vote was like 34-16 against him of keeping the word expressly, which came from the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union, and he was trying to get that put in, and that ended up being quite a contentious argument. But anyway, that's the way it happened. So we did not get expressly, which would mean if the word expressly had been included, then the very simple part of saying that the Congress has implied powers, then we wouldn't have had that First National Bank, because that is what Alexander Hamilton used to get the First National Bank through by saying, telling Jefferson those powers are implied in the necessary and improper clause. Necessary and proper clause. So then we stop and think what Patrick Henry said in the Virginia Ratification Convention. He said the necessary and proper clause will be the window through which all manners of evil shall pass. And with a necessary and proper clause and with the supremacy clause, it just pretty well opened the door to allow the Congress to do anything they wanted to.
So how many of these anti-federalists never signed because they were still adamant against this Constitution?
Well, the anti-federalists voted against it, but they were, as I said, the majorities were so overwhelming, 10-1 in the Senate and 5-1 in the House, they had no choice. Let's think of it in today's terms, Terry. What chances do you think anything would have of getting through the Congress if in the Senate the Democrats outnumbered the Republicans 10-1 and in the House they outnumbered them 5-1? What do you actually think would get done? And so that's what we're looking at. Exactly. Tried. They did the very best that they could, as I read the letters from Grayson and Richard Henry Lee, they did the very best that they could to get those in, to fight it, to get what Virginia actually wanted. And then from their letters, it's very simple. They were outvoted. They had no choice. And I was just looking through some of the letters, and here was one on June the 12th, which was before the huge argument in August. And this is from William Grayson to Patrick Henry. And he says, "I am exceedingly sorry. It is out of my power to hold out to you any flattering expectations on the score of amendments. It appears to me that both houses are almost wholly composed of Federalists." Wow. "Those who call themselves antis are so extremely lukewarm as scarcely to deserve the appellation. Some gentlemen here from motives of policy have it in contemplation to affect amendments which shall affect personal liberty alone, leaving the great points of the judiciary and direct taxation and to stand as they are. Their object is, in my opinion, unquestionably to break spirit of the party divisions. After this, I presume many of the most sanguine to go on coolly in sapping the independence of the state legislatures. In this system, however, of dividing imperio, they have opposed by a very heavy column from the little states, who, being in possession of rights they had no pretensions to in justice, are afraid of touching subjects which may bring into investigation and controversy their fortunate situation." And, you know, it just goes on and on where they make the points about the amendments. And one of the things, I know, Terry, you got the lessons that I sent out and for the past year or so. And one of the things that was alleged by Sentinel was the fact that financial head of the Congress during the Revolutionary War, and who Sentinel said had embezzled millions of dollars during that time. And there were, according to official congressional records, millions of dollars missing. I found it very unusual, a letter from Robert Morris. Now, we have to remember, Robert Morris signed the Declaration of Independence. Robert Morris was a delegate to the Constitutional Convention. He was a delegate to the Pennsylvania Ratification Convention. And then he ended up being a senator in the first Congress. But on August the 15th, to a fellow Pennsylvanian, Francis Hopkinson, I found this letter very, very, very puzzling in considering that he had been accused by Sentinel of embezzling millions of dollars. And he said, here's the letter to Francis Hopkinson, and it's short. "The House of Representatives are now playing with amendments. But if they make one truly so, I will hang. Poor Madison got so cursedly frightened in Virginia that I believe he has dreamed amendments ever since."
Mike?
Yes.
Did I lose you? Did I lose you?
Well, where did you lose me?
I don't know. It got quiet, and I your mic's been kind of fading, so I didn't know if I lost you there for a second.
Okay, did you hear the part, the letter from Robert Morris?
Most of it.
Okay. Well, he said if they passed the right amendment, he would hang, and he was accused of embezzling money. Why would a man write a letter like that about what amendment was he afraid of that would expose him?
Well, which one was that?
Well, that was Robert Morris who wrote the letter, and he had been accused of embezzling money. And in a letter to another member of Pennsylvanian, he says the House of Representatives are now playing with amendments, but if they make one truly so, I will hang.
So he wasn't referencing a specific one. He was referencing to some in general?
Yes, he was representing if they passed the right one, he would be exposed as, to me, that's almost an admission of guilt. Would you consider it otherwise?
Absolutely. No, that was definitely an admission of guilt.
And here was Theodore Sedgwick to Benjamin Lincoln, both strong Federalists. Here is a letter, a part of a letter that they wrote about the amendments, and it's dated July the 19th, 1789. This is before the real contention starts in the House of Representatives. And Sedgwick says, and I quote, "Mr. Madison's talents, respectable as they are, will for some time be lost to the public from his timidity. He is constantly haunted with the ghost of Patrick Henry. No man, in my opinion, in this country has more fair and honorable intentions or more ardently wishes the prosperity of the public, but unfortunately, he has not that strength of nerves which will enable him to set at defiance popular and factious clamors. His system of amendments we must fairly meet and must adopt. They will not shackle our operations of this government. It is a water gruel business, and I hope will be so managed as only to produce a more temperate habit in the body politic." In other words, he's saying he doesn't want the people protesting. "Those substantial amendments, which would have a tendency to produce a more complete and natural arrangement of our national union, we must despair of attaining at the present." So he is saying the resistance is so by the public, and see, this contradicts what Noah Webster said before. That's why these letters are so important, Terry. They reveal actually what was going on.
Mike, did you see anywhere in this where there was a demand that upon petition that there was a requirement for redress of grievance?
Yes, that was included, but there was, again, we go back to the point, they debated, and the Anti-Federalists wanted it stipulated that a grievance would have to be addressed or redressed by the government, and that was purposely left out. I will send you, and for anyone else who would like it, a list of the amendments. It's from the original document, and it shows all of the wording that the Senate scratched out. And the Senate scratched out all the wording which would have strictly held the government to reason as far as their operations. And this Federalist Senate wanted to make darn sure that nothing shackled their operation. And I'm sure there would be no difference today.
So let me get this straight. They did not have the authority from the states to write a new constitution. The delegates were not given that dictate or that, mandate.
Right.
They went there to amend the existing constitution, which was the Articles of Confederation.
Right.
They closed the doors, pulled the shades, and in secret changed the ratification process. So they violated the existing constitution. And then, in order to get the constitution ratified, even then, unconstitutionally amended the constitution and did not even follow the procedure that they had in the new constitution, much less the old one. And when the states submitted all of these different amendments, they basically ignored all but 17. So there was never a vote taken, not by the committee of the whole or by any convention. They never took a vote on any of the other of those 100.
They never saw. the committee, the first committee with 11 Federalists in the House of Representatives, whittled it down to 17, and the 17 that were sent to the Senate eliminated 5. So 12 were sent to the states for ratification out of over 100, which is totally against Article 5 of the Constitution, which says that all, if we went by the Constitution that they had written themselves, Article 5 would have insisted that all of those 100, I understand eliminating duplicates, that makes all the sense in the world, but 100 amendments should have been sent to the states, and the states could have picked the amendments they wanted to ratify if they followed their own Constitution.
Well, I know that the 11th Amendment was not ratified at the same time as the first 10, and the 12th was ratified probably, what, 9 years after the 11th?
Pretty close. That would be fairly accurate, yes.
So they only actually, at the time that the Constitution was ratified, there was only 10 amendments.
That is true. There was only 10 that were ratified in 1789, and those 10 became what we refer to as the Bill of Rights.
I guess I'm just, the more I think about it, the more it becomes difficult for me to perceive how they push this stuff through.
Well, here's the thing that we have to stop and think about, Terry, and I don't think most people even thought about this. I know I didn't for years. And that was very simply that the people who wrote the Constitution were the power in the first Congress, and they were the power in the first government. The president was a Federalist, Washington. He appointed all of the Supreme Court, all Federalists. The House of Representatives was 5-1 Federalist. The Senate was 10-1 Federalist. The people who wrote the Constitution controlled any amendments to their work in Pennsylvania, and they made darn sure that what they had put together in Philadelphia was not amended in any way that would harm what they had intended to do with the Constitution. And yes, they were sent to Philadelphia under direct authority of the U.S. Congress sitting at the time under the Articles of Confederation, and they were given the authority only to amend the Articles of Confederation. They were not given any powers to exceed that. And in the Virginia Ratification Convention, Patrick Henry got Edmund Pendleton to admit that on June the 4th, that they did not have the power to do what they did, but they did it anyway. And Patrick Henry said, I want to see all of the documents leading up to the convention that you used to usurp your authority, and they refused.
Was there ever a time in the history of the United States where there was an anti-federalist control in either of our houses?
Call Jefferson's first Congress, you could call that, because people have become, after from 1789 until 1800, so we're saying 11 years, 12 years basically, by the time Jefferson took office. For 12 years, the government had been controlled by the Federalists. And then we have, as you and I spoke of before, we had when Jefferson was elected and Adams lost, Adams stacked the federal courts with judges to make sure that they could stop anything that Jefferson's anti-federalists tried to do. And they were pretty doggone successful with most of it.
So here we are today in a time when the deep state is in a panic to do anything and everything they can to maintain the control that they've gained. And I'm just wondering how similar the time was then when they were trying to wrestle control back, how similar the times must have been at that time compared to today.
Well, Terry, that's the part I think is so beautiful about studying this, is because in so many ways when I sit and look at these letters, of course, today we don't have copies of the emails between the members of Congress, but back then they wrote letters, and those letters are still in the National Archives. You can go back and piece this together, and that I got into this about 10 days ago. I was going to write, basically, I was going to make a meme on the Bill of Rights. And then I got to looking at it, and I said, well, I'll just make it a lesson. And so I looked at the lesson and worked on the lesson, and then I said, oh, darn, this is going to be a huge article if I include excerpts from 141 letters to prove the points made. And so in essence, Terry, what I'm looking at right now is an e-book. I am working on an e-book, and the title of my e-book will be A Bill of Rights or A Bill of Goods.
Would you say that the Bill of Rights in some way made our unalienable rights more vulnerable?
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt about that. And if you look at some of these letters, this was the contention of many of the anti-federalists, is that the natural rights had been subverted basically with the Ten Amendments. And some of them, I think it was, I'm trying to think which one said, actually, the Ten Amendments did more damage to our inalienable rights than did the Constitution. But the one thing I look at, Terry, and I'm going to include this in my study or in my ebook, is the amendment that we should use that we don't. And you can't find where the Supreme Court really ever wants to look at the Ninth Amendment. And I really think they messed up and left the door open with the Ninth Amendment. And the federal courts stay away from the Ninth Amendment like it was a rabid dog.
Well, what's your take on this debate on whether or not the Bill of Rights can be enforced upon the states?
Well, that's the 14th Amendment, and we all know the 14th Amendment was never properly ratified. So that it was intended from the very beginning to be applicable only to the federal government. And because the reason being is because the various states felt like their Bill of Rights covered their citizens, and what they didn't want to be able to happen, which did happen with the Judiciary Act of 1789, what they didn't want to happen was the federal courts to be able to overturn Bill of Rights.
Well, did you read the actual text of the Ninth Amendment? I can read it.
No, but I will. Oh, please, go ahead.
I'll read it. I'll read it. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. And there we are with that term again, the people.
Right. Basically what we have there, Terry, would you read that again? Just please.
The enumeration in the Constitution, comma, of certain rights, comma, shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people.
Right. So in essence, what they are saying is that, and here is the reason for the Ninth Amendment, is because the Federalists at the Constitutional Convention, when they were asked to include a Bill of Rights, especially James Wilson from Pennsylvania, he kept up the argument that, hey, you don't need a Bill of Rights because you the people have so many rights, we can't list them all. So it would be impossible to list them all, and if we tried to list them all and put them into the Constitution, we might forget some because the people's rights are so numerous. So then George Mason countered with the fact, and it's a wonderful debate, George Mason countered in the convention, well, then why do you have a supremacy clause? So Mason pretty well nailed Wilson to the ground with that, because he said you have a supremacy clause which says that the federal government will have any law will be supreme over the state. And he said, so therefore we have to our Bill of Rights are non-existent in the states when met with the federal hammer. So that was a very contentious point, and that is the reason that the anti-federalists fought so hard, especially Grayson and Richard Henry Lee fought so hard for this Ninth Amendment. Because here we're saying the people have rights that you haven't listed. Did you mute yourself, buddy?
I just think the whole thing smells to high heaven, Mike. The whole thing smells to high heaven.
Terry, it was so, because I grew up, like everybody, probably everybody listening, I grew up believing our Constitution was just super. You know, I was told in Sunday school it was inspired by God. We had this thing. And then when you get right down to the nitty-gritty, you understand that the men who attended the Constitutional Convention, the men who were there were not common, ordinary people. They were members of what Alexander Hamilton called the wealthy and the well-born. So he basically said that we have the wealthy here who are going to construct a government that will control everyone. And if you go back to that letter from George Washington to John Jay a month before the Constitutional Convention, he said, we have a right to impose our imperial dignity and command obedience because the people aren't smart enough to know what's best for them. Now tell me that isn't the exact attitude of the people sitting in power today.
Well, it's the tip of the iceberg for them today. I mean, these people were arrogant. The people today are criminally insane. We're dealing with psychopaths. At least these people were just sociopaths.
Well, if you read Alexander Hamilton's speech on June the 18th, you might change your mind.
That he was a psychopath too?
Oh, he was power hungry, and the one thing about him was he was never wrong about anything. You can look at all the debates; he never admitted, even when they got to the end and they had the Constitution, he said it was a worthless fabric. Because he wanted a complete aristocracy or basically a king. And that's what he called for on June the 18th. But, Terry, here was something else I found looking through the letters. And this, to me, was most scary here. And this was written from John Randolph to St. George Tucker on September the 11th, 1789. Now, St. George Tucker was the brother of Thomas Tudor Tucker that I mentioned before that fought against James Madison to put expressly into the 10th Amendment. And this one
from
is
South
really
Carolina.
Scary here. Right. And St. George Tucker was from South Carolina as well. Here is the one that I read this one, and it kind of gave me cold chills. And here is the letter. It's very short. He says, a majority of the Senate, now remember those were Federalists, were for not allowing the state militia to have arms and if two-thirds had agreed, it would have been an amendment to the Constitution. They are afraid that the citizens will stop their full career to tyranny and oppression. Unquote.
Wow.
So think about the Second Amendment. What does the Second Amendment say? A well-regulated militia. Well, the Senate wanted to take all the arms away from the state militias. They didn't want to allow them to be armed. The only problem was that there were enough Federalists from being a two-thirds vote, because it came darn near being a two-thirds vote, and if it would have been, then the state militias would not have been allowed to have arms at all.
Well, the Second Amendment is the only place where anything is referenced as necessary. I know the necessary and proper clause, but the well-regulated militia was the only thing called necessary.
Right. Well, you know, the thing of it was is they could have said that you could have a well-regulated militia. There would have been a conflict. But again, I love this last sentence, and stop and think about this as we think about our inalienable rights to be armed to defend ourselves and our families today. Think about what they were saying in 1789. They are afraid, and he was talking about the Federalists, they are afraid that the citizens will career to tyranny and oppression. The sentiments we have today are not new.
Well, I'm going to throw something out and let you comment on it. I know that these guys had just fought, their own standing army. And I know that the intent of the Second Amendment being, well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, they were contemplating, you know, what they had just gone through and wanting to make sure that the states were well enough armed that they could never be forced into the kind of tyranny that they did by the Redcoats.
Right.
I wonder if these guys had ever contemplated that the standing army would have rocket-propelled grenades and interballistic missiles, any aircraft weapon or aircraft for that matter. Scalar weaponry, microwave weaponry. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do, and I don't think in those days.
Didn't the Second Amendment intend for the states to be able to defend themselves against whatever was brought against them from a standing army?
That's very interesting that you say that, Terry, because in going through the discussions in the ratification conventions and going through the studies in others, every time that the Second Amendment, almost every time, I hate to say every because there will be one somewhere, but in the majority of the discussions on the right of the people to keep and bear arms, it was provided because in case that the government had a standing army. So these people who think that they put that in there for hunting purposes they just haven't read the evidence to the contrary. Because when the people in the various states talked about the states, the people in the states having the right to be armed, they were to be armed against the tyranny of a federal government standing army. And Patrick Henry, on June the 7th of 1788, went into great detail. And that speech is so good, Terry. Next week, if it meets with your approval, I would really like to get into that that speech by that opposition to the Constitution by Patrick Henry, and to draw parallels with where we are today with what he predicted would happen on June the 7th of 1788 to this government, because he said that he nailed it in so many instances. And he mentioned specifically the standing army, and he also mentioned the standing army of federal and state sheriffs. Well, back then, he couldn't have said FBI, DEA, all this other stuff, but a federal sheriff to him was a federal law enforcement officer. And he said the people will be oppressed by the federal sheriff. He will come into your home, and what do you have to stop him? He said it much more eloquently than that. But basically what he was saying was exactly what happens today with the Supreme Court has used the drug wars to pervert the Fourth Amendment to where it's basically non-existent. No-knock warrants, you know, that is totally unconstitutional. And so if the Supreme Court gave the law enforcement the power of a no-knock warrant, the Supreme Court amended the Constitution. Where's the people yelling about that?
Well, there's been some, but they haven't got very far. What's your availability going to be? I mean, if you're going to be prepared next Thursday to go into that, I'd love to go into that. I mean, that's right down my alley as far as that's concerned. But are you going to be ready to do that next Thursday night?
At this point in time, I say I am.
Okay. Well, I'm game. I'm definitely game. I
don't think, Terry, that and one of the things the people haven't been taught is just the absolute brilliance of Patrick Henry. And the fact that this man had so much wisdom that he could see into the future and see exactly the way he paints what the government would become is just eerie. And the fact is, he said that the Bill of Rights, I can find the quote for you, that the Bill of Rights would do more harm to the people than it would help them. And how did that man have such vision? And I bring that back, Terry, to our very point, that vision point, with the fact that the other people that we refer to as founders constantly referred to him as the most devout Christian in the group. And yet he had this vision.
You know, the interesting thing for me is I believe that people today and in recent generations have believed that we are the smartest generations. We're the most advanced. That we have a vision of reality and truth that far exceeds those of past history. And yet I look back at some of the writings in the 1500s from some of the reformers, and they are, their visionary writing is just amazing. So it doesn't surprise me at all that Patrick Henry and some of these others, Luther Martin, etc., you know, had great visionary power. What is surprising to me is that we have been so dumbed down. You know, you look at prophecy and you look at scripture, and it talks about how even the elite would be deceived and there would be great deceptions in the latter days. I see that today. I believe that that's where we are. I believe that we have been since, you know, really since the time of the Reformation, we've been in a great deception. And I believe that all of what we're bringing out here and what you're bringing out here is a part of that deception. And I think interesting that you're bringing it out. I mean, because it states that as the evil increases, as the deception increases, so will the spirit. So So I'm glad that we are. I think we're part of that. I think we're part of that increased spirit of discernment is designed to counteract the evil, and that's basically what we're looking at. And this great deception is not going to happen in the future. It's already here. It's been here with us for a while.
Well,
your comments on that?
For years in my writing, I have referred to our educational system as the public fool system. So if it is, in fact, the public fool system, and you and I have talked about the Reese Commission and how three nonprofit organizations took over the education system in this country over 100 years ago, and it was intended to dumb down the people, and it has succeeded. And I've often said, if you've got a public fool system, and along those lines, I would like to, I found this quote in a letter from Patrick Henry to James Monroe, and a discussion about after the 10 amendments were, basically ratified by 3/4 of the states. And Patrick Henry wrote to James Monroe, and he said that he claimed that the amendments injured rather than served the cause of liberty. And he promised to Monroe that he would continue to fight against them. He insisted that the 10 amendments acted only to, and I quote, to lull suspicion and cast an impediment on the way of those who wished to retrench the exorbitancy of power granted away from the people and to the central government.
Well,
that was from the visionary Patrick Henry.
Well, we
got
about.
Were we ever taught that Patrick Henry opposed the Bill of Rights?
I don't think so.
Were we ever taught to oppose
remember.
The Constitution?
I don't. Well, only from you. You're the one that's brought that out more than anybody I've ever heard. But I don't believe I've ever heard of anybody opposing the Bill of Rights. Anybody.
Think of Sentinel's description. It's a tub before a whale. You wanted to get the whale's attention so that they wouldn't sink the ship. So basically that's what Sentinel said the Bill of Rights was, and Patrick Henry backed that up. So did Richard Henry Lee and William Grayson.
I've never heard anybody other than in our discussions – have I ever heard any of that? Forget school, anywhere. I've never read it. I've never seen it. I've never heard it.
Well, you might not be surprised at how many enemies I've made by saying this.
Well, I wouldn't be too surprised. I can see people's jaws drop into their chest if they really knew half of what you've presented here.
Well, I talked with a gentleman that I've known for some time in Nevada today, and we were talking about this very issue because I spoke on this subject today at on People's Patriot Network. I spoke about this for an hour, and this good friend Robert Hudson called me afterwards, and we were talking about the a Bill of Rights, and I drew the analogy. I said, we are like people. We look at our Constitution and Bill of Rights like a people getting on a ship, and we look over and we see the security of lifeboats, and that's the way we look at our Bill of Rights, but yet those lifeboats are full of holes.
Well, I guess what it really boils down to, Mike, is that just as I've said many times about the Constitution doesn't defend itself. The Bill of Rights doesn't defend itself. Our unalienable rights do not defend themselves. So we certainly cannot rely on any of this codified law that was put into place by the Federalists to in any way defend our rights. That's what's becoming obvious
to
me.
But Terry, one of the things I try to reiterate at every time when I make one of these presentations is that the Constitution as ratified by the states is totally different than, in many ways different, not totally, but in many ways different from what the Supreme Court uses as their baseline, if they have a baseline. But and Jefferson and Madison both said, if you want to know the true meaning of the Constitution, go back to the ratification conventions and see what the people were promised, because what the people were promised constituted a contract. And that's what they ratified. And that is one of the things that I've mentioned before. The only person sitting on the Supreme Court that agrees with that is Thomas, Clarence Thomas.
Well, we're getting close to time, and I thought maybe this is a good place to wrap it up. You want to make your closing comment for today? And I'm going to do something a little different at the end of the show. Instead of playing the last part of Government Roger Miller's song, I thought I'd play the Sound of Silence by Disturbed. If anybody hasn't heard that, you might want to stick around and listen to it. I'm not a Disturbed fan particularly, but the way that they did that particular song and how relevant it is today, I think is interesting. So I'm going to play it, but take a couple minutes and wrap us up, Mike.
Well, Terry, what I would like to tell the people and the people who have listened and said, well, I'm not sure this guy knows exactly what he's talking about. And my teacher told me different and I read this and I read that. I would tell you folks, please investigate. But if you would, at some point in time, I'm going to put out all of this thing on the Bill of Rights in an ebook, which will be very inexpensive. And I will document parts from the letters. I will use source documents completely throughout to prove what I have said tonight, to show exactly what happened, because I can't find where this has ever been discussed in detail to this extent. One guy, the last time I can find anything where it was even covered to any detail whatsoever was in the 1950s. And, of course, that's 70 years ago now. So it hasn't been covered, and I think that's intentionally. We know that the Anti-Federalists were not mentioned for 100 years in any academic works in this country. There had to be a reason for that. Why do you leave out that big a part of history? So I would ask you to jump in, do your own research. Go find these documents. Some are available on the internet, but I promise you not all of them are, just like Sentinel. So go ahead, my friend Terry. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Oh, guys, wow. I'm seeing now Terry just sent me a notice, and he says that he was disconnected. Well, I'm not sure if I'm on here or not. So anyway, guys, thanks for tuning in if you can still hear me. I hope everyone has a wonderful week.
Are you still there, Mike?
I'm here, buddy.
I was disconnected for a while. It just dropped me.
Yeah, I told the folks if they could still listen, I told them that you had been disconnected.
Good. Well, time to wrap. It was a good show. Thank you very much, Mike. We'll see everyone next week
My
on
pleasure.
Thursday night. Have a good one.
Thank you, buddy. Please welcome
Pister. You're welcome. Thank you.
Darkness, my own friend, I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its scenes while I was sleeping, and the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence. In restless dreams I walked alone, narrow streets of cobblestone, 'neath the halo of a street lamp, I turned my collar to the cold and damp. When my eyes were stared by the flash of a neon light that split the night and touched the sound of silence. And in the naked light I saw 10,000 people, maybe more. People talking without speaking. People hearing without listening. People writing. Silence. Well, said I, you do not know. Silence like a cancer grows. Hear my words that I might teach you. Take my arms that I might reach you. But my go.